This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by Avalum Health, the makers of the TheraWorks Protect U-Pack. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast will discuss hypertension management in the older patient. According to the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, in 2016, the prevalence of cardiovascular disease, or CVD, was greatest among older adults, at 25% for those over the age of 70 years. The major modifiable risk factors for CVD have not changed: tobacco smoke, high blood cholesterol, high blood pressure, physical inactivity, diabetes, and obesity. Yet, in a 2018 New England Journal of Medicine review of the initial treatment of hypertension, despite the medications available and the years of applicable research, the rate of hypertension control in United States adults was only 61%. And as a relatively new geriatrician, I learned in 2004 from the 7th report of the Joint National Commission that systolic blood pressure should be the primary target for diagnosis and management of older people with hypertension. I asked myself, was that it? We were still years away from the specialty of geriatrics being declared, but were we sure of the approach to managing a chronic issue in this unique segment of the adult population? In his 2009 Shattuck lecture, esteemed clinician and thought leader in hypertension, Aram Chabanian, declared, "The treatment of hypertension has been one of medicine's major successes in the past half century." So where are we today in the management of hypertension in the older adult? Well, I can think of no one better to lead us through this discussion around hypertension than national and international leader in geriatric cardiology, Dr. Michael Rich. And we are extremely fortunate to have Dr. Rich with us now. Dr. Rich is a professor of medicine and cardiology at the Washington University School of Medicine and director of the Cardiac Rapid Evaluation Unit at Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis. His primary research focus has been the prevention and treatment of cardiovascular disease in the aging population. He has participated in numerous investigator-initiated and multi-center clinical trials and has published extensively in cardiovascular disease and risk reduction. He is a past president of the Society of Geriatric Cardiology. He serves on numerous editorial boards, and he is a consulting editor for the Journal of the American Geriatric Society. He also has won the American Geriatric Society Edward Henderson Award in 2014 for his contributions to geriatric medicine. Dr. Rich, it is a pleasure to welcome you to AMDA On The Go.
Well, Wayne, thank you very much for the kind introduction. It's really my pleasure to be here.
Dr. Rich, I typically like to start the conversation with somewhat of a historical perspective to set our framework for a discussion. When I was a geriatric fellow in 2000, I remember the debates on either side of the aisle over how to manage cardiac conditions in older adults correctly. There was no consensus. In a 2015 Cardiology Magazine article about you, you said how you diagnose and treat a patient with cardiac problems at age 80 can be very different from how you would manage a patient at age 50. To the geriatrician, this statement is fundamentally obvious, but I fear that to many of our colleagues who are in the trenches, the statement may not be so. How has the assessment and management of cardiovascular status in the older adult evolved over the past 10 to 20 years? Have we now reached some consensus in care? And what should every provider be aware of today when it comes to the older adult and cardiovascular disease?
Well, I'm not sure that we've really reached a consensus. I think we are making progress and moving towards a consensus. And I think that the geriatricians, of course, have always recognized that the older adult population is exceedingly heterogeneous and that therefore each patient must be managed individually, taking into account their multiple chronic conditions, goals of care, life expectancy, and so forth. In cardiology, on the almost other extreme of the spectrum, it's typically been very much approached through evidence-based guidelines and often disease-centric rather than patient-centric. And as a result of the fact that, as you well know, and our audience well knows, most of the large clinical trials that have formed the basis for the cardiology guidelines have tended to either outright excluded older adults or included older adults that were generally healthier than those who we see in routine clinical practice. So less comorbidities, less frail, not nursing home residents and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so there's always been a question of whether the clinical trials and the associated guidelines are applicable to the older adult population. I think that this is still problematic. We're going to talk about the SPRINT trial, which I think is better than many of the studies that have been conducted previously in terms of enrollment criteria and applicability, but certainly not perfect. And I think that what has happened is that in the cardiology world, as a result largely of a couple of technological developments, which I will mention shortly, there is a growing understanding that older adults need to be managed individually, that there's no one-size-fits-all, and that we have to evaluate their functional status, their frailty, and so forth in making decisions about what's appropriate care for each individual. And the two major advances that have occurred technologically, and cardiology is largely technologically driven, have been the development of transcatheter aortic valve replacement, which really started as a procedure aimed at individuals who were not considered suitable candidates for open heart replacement of the aortic valve, who are not considered suitable candidates for traditional surgical aortic valve replacement. And these were largely older patients. The early trials of TAVR, median age was typically 83, 84. And these were individuals who had multiple comorbid conditions, often were frail. And this really called attention to this population for the first time amongst general practicing cardiologists. These were patients who now were potentially suitable candidates for a procedure, and cardiologists had to pay attention to whether this person was likely to benefit from such a procedure in the context of their other medical problems. The other procedure is ventricular assist devices, which also we've learned the efficacy is largely related to what we might consider geriatric factors, frailty, multimorbidity, renal insufficiency, and so forth. So I think that that there has been progress in moving towards a consensus. The consensus is that there is no one-size-fits-all and that we really need to pay attention to each individual patient, their coexisting issues.
So let's get to a little bit more about what we do know. So in a September 2019 editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Director Association, JAMDA, entitled Hypertension Management in the Very Old, Dr. Wilbert Arano discussed the 2017 American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association guidelines, influenced in part by the 2015 SPRINT trial, and the controversy around whether the guidelines were applicable to older adults. It still seems very complicated, as you've already alluded, diabetes, renal disease, heart failure, stroke, albuminuria, et cetera, et cetera. This may be a nebulous question, but what is the source of truth today with regard to managing blood pressure in the older adult? Are hypertension guidelines and or trials reflecting where care of older adults should be?
Let me begin by just making a few comments about the SPRINT trial. This truly was a landmark study involving over 9,000 adults. There was pre-specified subgroup analysis of individuals 75 years of age or older, about 2,600 patients enrolled in SPRINT who were 75 and older. Yeah. And The main focus of the trial was the comparison of two strategies for lowering blood pressure. One strategy was the, at the time, traditional target of less than 140 over 90, and this was compared to a more intensive blood pressure reduction regimen with a target of a systolic blood pressure of less than 120 and diastolic less than 80. And the main findings of this study were that there were dramatic improvements in essentially all major outcomes that were evaluated. The primary outcome was a composite of cardiovascular events and cardiovascular death, and this was reduced across the board. In fact, the study was discontinued early because there was about a 25% reduction in this primary endpoint. Additionally, there was about a 27% reduction in all-cause mortality. And very importantly for today's discussion, these benefits were similar, if not greater, in the over 75 subgroup of the SPRINT trial. Additionally, they find three groups of by function, which were fit, less fit, and frail, and the benefits were comparable regardless of fit status, functional status, including in the frail population. So these data provide very compelling evidence that in people over 75, even frail older adults, that there was significant benefit in improving heart outcomes, cardiovascular outcomes. Additionally, quality of life was improved in those who had the intensive blood pressure reduction. And in a subgroup, SPRINT Mind, which looked at cognitive function, there was a trend towards less dementia, and there was significant reduction in development of mild cognitive impairment in the aggressively treated group. So I think that this really does provide a framework for how to treat high blood pressure in at least a selected population of older adults. The principal, this downside of the SPRINT trial was that, as with other studies and what I alluded to earlier, is that there were a large number of exclusion criteria. Patients with diabetes were excluded. Nursing home residents were peremptorily excluded, and there's a fairly long list of significant comorbidities they were excluded. And an analysis of the generalizability of the SPRINT findings to people over 75 concluded that only about a third of people over 75 would have been eligible for the SPRINT trial. And so we're left with the results of SPRINT appear to be definitely applicable to about a third of people over age 75, but less certainty about the remaining two-thirds. And so to your question, I think that it's reasonable to apply the SPRINT guidelines SPRINT results to this one-third of the population who fulfill the SPRINT criteria, to take a more nuanced approach to the substantial proportion of the population in this age group who really would not have been eligible for participation in the SPRINT study.
We will return to our interview after this brief message from Avadam, the creators of TheraWorks. What are you missing to drive better outcomes for recurrent UTI patients, from mounting antibiotic-resistant concerns to unproven over-the-counter remedies? Your options for preventing urinary tract infections in post-acute care facilities have been limited until now, safe for a variety of urogenital uses and won't contribute to resistance. The TheraWorks Protect UPAC is the safe, clinically proven, convenient hygiene solution you've been missing. To learn more about how the UPAC can become part of your UTI prevention protocols, visit seewhatsmissing.com.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Rich about hypertension management in the older adult. So Dr. Rich, extending on my last question, the two-thirds who really didn't qualify for SPRINT, let's maybe focus maybe on those. So it seems to me, especially as we're talking about an audience that is largely folks who are post-acute and long-term care providers, that a short-term skilled nursing facility stay could be an opportune time to take stock of an elder's chronic issues, 2 weeks' time to make some beneficial modifications in real time. And when it comes to hypertension or even cardiovascular disease in general, I guess my question to you is, what should practitioners look for while in this setting and address to help ensure system stability moving forward? And, how would you want this population to be approached?
First of all, I'm not really convinced that the two-week stay in post-acute care is the optimal time to be making major changes. Typically, these are individuals who've just been in the hospital, and they're going to post-acute care because are not ready to go back home yet if they were admitted from home. And this is usually because they've experienced some functional decline in the hospital and maybe have blood pressure lability and other factors that may not make this the ideal time for making major changes in their medication regimen, including management of their hypertension and other cardiovascular disorders that they may have. I do think, though, that it is an appropriate time to develop a general approach to each individual patient, looking at the breadth of their comorbidities, what appears to be their overall prognosis, and particularly examining goals of care, preferences, defining preferences for care, and later perhaps applying that knowledge to the management of the patient. And with respect to hypertension, as you would expect in the SPRINT trial, to achieve a lower blood pressure, a more aggressive blood pressure, there was a requirement for more medication. So this is, on average, one additional medication added on to what in some of these patients is already 10 to 15 or more medications, and potential for drug interactions and other adverse effects escalates as we keep adding medications. And this may not be in line with the individual patient's goals of care, and may not really care if their blood pressure is 5 or 10 points lower, if it means that they have to take more medications and expose themselves to more side effects. So I think that this 2 week stay in the post-acute care does provide an excellent opportunity for trying to identify those goals and plan subsequent care accordingly.
Your logic to me is spot on, and I couldn't help agree with you. And I think that we may have one or two podcasts about that very thing in our past. Dr. Rich, as has become customary in the time that we have remaining, I wish to be a little provocative with you, respectfully so. While we have not been talking about congestive heart failure, in what some consider a landmark report in 1995 in the New England Journal of Medicine, an article entitled "A Multidisciplinary Intervention to Prevent the Readmission of Elderly Patients with Congestive Heart Failure," you and others recommended that close follow-up of older adults may provide additional benefits beyond simply reducing the likelihood of exacerbations of heart failure. Yet 25 years later, we are still seeing very high readmission rates for heart failure. Analogously, in a recent review on acute hypertension from the New England Journal, the author reports that non-adherence to prescribed antihypertensive medications is the most common precipitating factor. So, over the past two decades, it seems like we're missing something when it comes to the assessment and management of cardiovascular disease in the older adult. And why can't we seem to grasp the brass ring, so to speak, in this care for the elder population? What would success look like in the management of hypertension or cardiovascular disease in general? And what will the healthcare system need to do to accomplish that success?
With regard to the readmissions issue, which obviously is still front and center in healthcare in the United States today, I think that we have made some progress. We have fewer readmissions for heart failure, the lower readmission rate for heart failure than we did back in the 90s. There's whether that is due to improved patient care or not is been challenged because some studies have shown that although we've reduced admissions, we've actually had increase in mortality following hospitalizations. Yes. And so that's really called into question whether readmissions is even appropriate target for intervention. Right. I think, though, that that there's a couple of other important issues. One is that the majority of patients who are discharged from the hospital with heart failure who are readmitted, the majority of them are not readmitted for heart failure. These are typically multimorbid older patients, and often their readmissions are for other medical problems. And I think this calls to attention the fact that that we can't manage these patients in disease silos. We can't just focus on their heart failure. We have to look at the whole patient. We have to pay attention to their other medical problems and being and address all of these problems more or less simultaneously in order to achieve the best outcomes. Mm-hmm. I think that the other aspect of it is that we still do a poor job on the transitions in care. Yes. Whether the person is going from the hospital to post-acute care, as we just discussed, or going back home or going back to a nursing facility or to a nursing facility for long-term care, we simply are not doing a good job on these transitions in ensuring that that they're going to be getting the proper medications, that they understand how to take their medications, that they're getting appropriate follow-up, that the family is involved in the care as appropriate, and other facets of care that are really contingent on an effective transition from the hospital to the post-hospital environment. And so looking towards the future, I do think that there needs to be increased emphasis on that. And in particular, there must be a strategy of reimbursement that compensates providers for optimal transitional care following hospitalization. And the same thing is true when individuals go from post-acute care back to home. I think that there's often a lot lost in the transition there, and they go back home, and then they end up back in the hospital shortly after that or have other complications. So I think focusing on the whole patient and particularly on transitions of care will ultimately lead to better outcomes for all of these patients.
Well, I can definitely assure you that the American Geriatric Society and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine are both looking at the transitions in care piece continue to. It's a work in progress. And the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Medicine recently published a paper on best practices for the transition back home. So your words are very much to the point and in tune to what we're trying to do today. So thank you for that. We have been privileged to speak with and learn from Dr. Michael Rich. What an opportunity. Dr. Rich, thank you so very much for spending your time with AMDA On The Go.
Thank you, Wayne. It was my pleasure.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.org/podcast. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this broadcast is provided by Avadem Health, the creators of TheraWorks Protect. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.